Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are Groundworks, Inc. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we design, install, and maintain gardens here in New York City and elsewhere.
Not last week, though. Last week, we got poked.
Yeah, we did. We did get poked.
We got poked in UEnd.
So we're going to be a little serene because of our latest visitor.
Yes.
In today's show, we have a fellow garden designer with us, Jan Johnson, who was born in New York City and now works in Westchester, and her work is gorgeous. And that's Jan Johnson with an S-E-N. Welcome, Jan.
Well, hello there.
How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm thrilled to be with you today.
Thank you. So this morning, Jan and I were talking about today's show and getting oriented, and we discovered that you were actually born in New York City and that you lived in Brooklyn.
Yes. I grew up in Brooklyn, went to public schools there, and it's my home.
So tell us, you had some really beautiful memories of how you came into the, like, green plant world because of Brooklyn.
You could never believe it coming from where I came from. I grew up, as you can imagine, you're both from Brooklyn, in an apartment. And my schoolyard was all concrete, and there was not much grass or many trees at all where I lived, Sunset Park, Brooklyn. But the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens was my salvation.
Yeah. And you also mentioned Greenwood Cemetery.
And Greenwood Cemetery, absolutely. In fact, my grandmother would take her kids there on picnics on Sunday. That was the family picnic ground.
Yeah, for my family, too. We actually have these hilarious pictures of my dad as a little boy, like, frolicking around
the Greenwood Cemetery. All the after church, all the families went to Greenwood Cemetery.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, that was really how the parks, you know, the idea for a public park came about, was because of the cemeteries.
Yeah, and some of them are, as you know, are quite beautiful.
Yeah.
Beyond Greenwood, there's some in Massachusetts, and there's some classic ones that are real.
Yeah.
They're real parks, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
So then you went to college. You said you went to a Quaker college, and you studied landscape architecture, and then you got a master's degree in planning. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, what happened for me was that and this is many decades ago, I went to an art high school in New York City, but I also loved plants.
Uh-huh.
So my guidance counselor, nobody back then knew the term landscape designer, especially if you lived in the city.
Right.
So my guidance counselor said, well, you like drawing and you like plants, why don't you be a botanical illustrator? And I told her, well, I was thinking of becoming an architect. Well, nobody knew about landscape architecture. So I went off to study architecture, and I went, as part of my college days, to Japan.
Uh-huh.
And worked as an intern in a Japanese architecture office. But what happened to me was that I lived in a city called Kyoto, where all the legendary Japanese gardens are.
Right.
And on the weekends, I would visit those gardens, and I just flipped out. I just said, what? This is the most beautiful place I've ever been. And I went back to the architecture office, and I put the buildings in the side of the hill underground and started to design all the pathways and the trees. And my sensei said to me, you are not an architect. You are a landscape architect. Uh-huh. And he sent me off to a landscape architecture office in Japan.
Cool. And then you had some training in Honolulu.
Oh, yes. So what happened then was from there I came home to New York and went through a major culture shock, as you can imagine.
Right.
And thought, well, what do I do now? I want to study landscape architecture. This is what I... And I went to University of Hawaii, and that was back when, you know, tuition was like $200 a semester.
Right.
Seriously.
Yeah.
And it was very inexpensive for me to go there, and that's where I studied landscape architecture.
And what a place to learn about plants.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. It was great. It was just fabulous. I don't know why I left.
Yeah.
it was great.
Yeah. Well, you jumped from one island of Manhattan to, you know,
you
to the big island.
Yeah, you've done a little bit of island hopping, Jan.
Yeah.
You know, but I did come back, and I'm so glad I did, because, you know, the New York area is just so beautiful. And of course, New York now, as you well know, has become quite a center of design, whether it's the High Line or Central Park or whatever it is. It's just
right.
It's got caught up with everybody. And
yeah.
Then some.
And so then you went on to teach. You were a professor at Columbia University's defunct landscape design program, sadly, that's closed. And then you also do some teaching at New York Botanic Garden.
That's right. Because, you know, I've been in now this profession for 45 years.
Wow.
And when I came out and I graduated University of Hawaii and I came back to New York, it was not that well developed, the profession here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was still concrete plazas. This was in the 1970s.
Uh-huh.
And so I went up to this hotel called Mohonk.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know Mohonk?
Yeah.
And I got myself a job there just right out of college, and the head gardener was from France. He had studied in Versailles. And not studied in Versailles, excuse me, he worked in Versailles.
Uh-huh.
He had been trained since he was 13 years old to become a professional gardener to work on all the grand estates in France.
Right.
But he decided to come to America to make his fortune, and that's how I met him. And so I then went to work with him on the grounds of Mohonk Mountain House, which is a beautiful place for people who haven't been there. It is quite...
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
About 2 hours outside New York City.
Uh-huh.
And I learned everything from him about planting and plant bed prep and flowers and everything.
Like the real nuts and bolts, right?
So then I, you know, put that together, and so I had the hands-on experience as well.
So, Jan, how was it in the 70s as a woman landscape architect? Was it hard?
Like, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous because it was just not... It's so hard to explain to young women today what it was like back then.
Right.
It was just not done. You were not... That was not your place.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a young woman, I had to constantly prove to everybody that I knew what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly. It was like I was representing my gender. You know, I was representing
yes.
womanhood, you know,
yeah.
in the profession. So I had to know all the plant names. Guys would query me and say, okay, what's the name of that? And I would say, Camas cypress, Specifera filifera aurea.
Uh-huh.
You know, and then they were so surprised I knew it. And, of course, then, of course, that didn't help. It didn't help that you knew it.
No, they didn't,
like,
right.
You're just constantly being challenged. And today, of course, you go into... I was the only female in landscape architecture classes.
Mm-hmm.
Today
yes.
you go in, I think it's mostly female. I'm not
yeah.
sure, but because I haven't done. But it's, you
yeah.
know, it's nothing like it was. You just had to excel at whatever it was that you choose to do just in order to get an acknowledgement.
Right, right.
But, you know, now women are, you know, Beatrix Ferran is recognized now as a great designer, and, as you know, and New York Botanic Gardens are lauding them, and it's just wonderful.
Yeah, it is. Do you happen to know a woman? She was in Brooklyn Heights, Alice Ires.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she's a lovely lady.
And as a matter of fact, her book was one of the very first books I got way back when.
Oh, good.
Way back when, you know, in the 70s.
Yeah.
There weren't that many books out, and she was one of them.
Yeah. Yes. She was lovely. She was at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and she was friends with a woman named Betty Skoltz. Do you know Betty Skoltz?
No, I don't.
She's actually a horticulturalist from Cape Town.
Wow.
And Carmen and I got to know her and be friends with her when we were at the Hort Society of New York, and she is one of the grand ladies
of horticulture.
Oh,
that's great.
I mean, ladies were allowed to be botanical artists, Jan. Like, botanical art was okay for ladies to do, but, you know, planning and
it was just a hobby. It was never a profession.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your book.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Yeah. So, new book out, Heaven is a Garden, published by St. Lynn's Press.
Wonderful St. Lynn's Press.
Yes.
Yeah. Great publishing house.
So, tell us a little bit about why you chose that title and kind of what it meant to you to write this book.
Well, you know, as I mentioned to you in the beginning, I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in small apartments. And so when I would go to a park or to the Botanic Gardens or wherever, it was like heaven to me. It was. It was like unlike people who grew up with lawns and all, I really did cherish being out in the green world. And I actually did not come up with the title. The publisher, Paul Kelly of St. Lynn's Press, suggested it to me, and he did it a little shyly and said, would you consider this as a name for your book? And the minute he said, Heaven is a Garden, I went, that's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Thank you so much. And and I do feel that words have a resonance, and I feel that those words, even though, you know, some people might say, what are you referring to? I do feel like it accurately represents what I'm writing about in my book.
Well, exactly. And honestly, when you look at your website, and I spend a lot of time looking at all of your photos and your work, it is gorgeous. Very geometric, but there's such rhythm patterning, but it's so seamless, and it is very tranquil. That is exactly the word, and serene. And your book really is a lot about the design and how to achieve that, because the photos are effortless. Like, they took my breath away. The stonework and the water and the repetition and just the
I have a feeling that the time in Japan had a big impact on you, Jan.
Very big impact.
Yeah.
I just lived in those gardens on the weekends, and I just said,
it seems like you absorbed it.
How do they do this?
Yeah.
And you know, this is an interesting thing I talk about in my talks, where I know why I started to study landscape design was because of the feeling I experienced in those wonderful Japanese gardens. And so there I go, very diligently studying in landscape architecture in the college classes. But nowhere did anyone ever talk about how to create an outdoor space that makes you feel the way I felt, you know, tranquil, uplifted, elevated.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk about you guys know, because
right.
you do it for a living. They talk about drainage, you talk about access, they talk about shade patterns. And I said, yeah, but when do you talk about how to make a space that makes you feel great?
Where's the emotion in it? Exactly.
And because they never did, I had to figure it out on my own. And it's, you know, all these decades now where I've been thinking about it. And that's what I wanted to share with everyone in my book, Heaven is a Garden.
So one of the kind of some design themes that come up in your book are the wonders of nature, simplicity, sanctuary, and delight.
Yes.
How to highlight a power spot in a new project. Sheltered corners, east-facing gate, auspicious. Trees for special atmosphere, the mysteries of color, rock renaissance in a garden, and the magic of water. So these are kind of design words that have emotional feeling associated with them. You were telling me about some ancient techniques for creating serene outdoor spaces. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Oh, I would love to. I would love to. And, you know, you just have to shut me up after a while. But I'll give you an example, because when I say looking to the ancient traditions for insight into how to create a space that makes you feel wonderful, every tradition talks about the four directions, whether it's the Celtics or Hawaiian or South American or Japanese or Native American, whatever it is, they all refer to the four directions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our daily life, we have GPS. You ask a kid where north is, they have no clue.
And right?
You ask a grown-up where north is, they wouldn't know at this point.
Yeah.
Whereas in not so distant past, the four directions really did run our lives, because the sun came from the south and rose in the east, and, you know, and they didn't have electric lights, so everybody knew where north south was. Well, I found it very interesting that all the cultures ascribe the same qualities to the four directions. When I say qualities, I mean like characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about that in the book. Like, for example, the north side is always the shady side, since the sun is in the south. So the north side of a building, the north side of a tree, the north side of a garden, that's the shady side, and that's the quiet side. So if someone has a backyard and it's in the north side of the property, and this could be in Brooklyn too, and it's the shady side, then work with that. And this is what I talk about. North is associated with stone in all the cultures, and meditative gardens, contemplative, and viewing gardens. And so when you look to the north, work with that and highlight that, you know, with the ferns and the astilbes and the hostas and whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
And going along with that, I'll just say one more thing about the directions, although I go on to it more in the book, is that of all the four directions, the most auspicious direction considered by all the cultures is east.
Now, why is that?
Well, now this is so interesting. I talk about this. If you look at Gothic cathedrals, like, say, St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York or St. John the Divine in New York or in Europe, the congregations always face east.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about it. You're right. Yeah, the cathedral is facing west, but the congregation is
always facing east.
Yes.
If you look at the great old libraries of the world, not the new ones, but the old ones, let's say the 42nd Street Library.
Uh-huh.
And this is true for all the great libraries of the world. The windows, they're always facing what direction?
East.
And the Native American teepees, they always had them open to the east. And Vastu, which is like feng shui, it's
an
Indian form of understanding space. They always tell students to face east when they're studying for their exams. So what is it about east, right? Well, most people will say, well, east is where the sun rises, and so that makes a lot of sense, you know. And that's true.
Right.
That's absolutely true. That's where the sun rises, so people face east. However, what they've discovered is that our synapses in our brain fire more rapidly when we face east. Isn't that fascinating?
That's cosmic.
Yeah, you're freaking me out right
now. That's cosmic. We're getting on a whole celestial plane.
It was the moon last night, I think. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, the moon. And so east is also the direction where plants grow the best. If you have a vegetable garden or a rose garden, you should get the eastern light, because plants wake up the way we do, and they want their sunlight right when they wake up. They don't want to wait till 2 p.m. in the afternoon for their sun. They want that sun when they wake up so they can do the best growing. And that's a wise gardener secret. I always have the veggie garden getting the sun, east light.
Uh-huh.
So, however, one more thing with the east, because this is true for any kind of garden design. Vastu also says all front doors should face east, and gates to a city should face east. And if you think about it, when you lay out a building or you lay out a garden bed, they say you orient the building.
Mm-hmm.
What does orient mean?
Right, orient, just the word,
east.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
East. Orient means
yeah.
east.
Yes. Yeah.
So they always want you to, the orientation of a building is just what it is, to face east orientation. Uh-huh. I always thought that was so fabulous. And that was like a light bulb that went off in my head when I learned all, you know, I studied this and I went, wow. So east is really the most auspicious direction. And that's something should all garden designers should know about.
Mm-hmm.
So there you are. That's an example of what I'm saying, looking to the ancient traditions.
Okay, we have to take a break. Stay on the line, Jan. This is fascinating, and I wish I had a pencil so I could take notes. Hang on.
It's all in the book.
Yeah. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
Wand. Tomorrow, everyone in the world would have enough food to eat that was culturally appropriate and delicious. The planet would be thriving because all the food would have been grown and produced in a way that sustains us, both our bodies and our world. But man, I do not have a magic wand. What I do have is you and this radio station, the Heritage Radio Network. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help lead the way to a future that's more delicious, that's more fun, where we're healthier, where the planet's healthier, and we want you to be a part of that. We can't do it without you. As a nonprofit radio station, we depend on the support of our listeners. So take a minute out of your day, visit the website, and click the big beating donate tab. Throw us a few bucks. Every bit helps. We're counting on you.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are here with Jan Johnson, with an E, landscape architect and author of the new book by St. Lin's Press called Heaven is a Garden. So, Jan, let's talk about trees for special atmosphere.
Oh, that'd be great.
I love to talk about trees. I don't think people pay enough attention to their placement, to their choice
right.
at all.
To the depth of their planting.
To the depth of their planting, or they pay too much attention to the depth. So tell us about that,
trees?
That
I
process.
I would love to tell you
yeah.
about trees. I actually, many years ago, wrote a book on trees for the Ortho series. It was called Ortho's All About Trees. And so I did a lot of research for that book, as you can imagine, because it was just strictly about trees, all the different varieties and all. But when I did all that studying about trees, of course, the thing that came through to me were the messages of the trees. And that was the one thing that they had no interest in talking about in that book.
Yeah.
they looked at me askance and they said, nope, cutting that part out. And what I was talking about is how people can literally attune to a tree. And maybe you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, some people hug trees, but you don't have to hug them to attune to it.
Right.
You literally just have to be with the tree. Am I starting to lose the audience?
No.
Elaborate on that, Jen. Explain, you know, because again, this reminds me of the influence of the Japanese, mm-hmm. your experience in Japan, right? I mean, that's surely influenced your thinking about this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it even goes beyond that, which I'd love to share this with you. It's not in my book, but when I was in high school, I joined the New York City Science Fair, and I did an experiment called the effect of sound on the growth of plants. Now, you have to understand, this was in the 1960s, and my science teacher laughed out loud when I told her. She thought it was the most ridiculous thing she ever heard of. She thought it was ridiculous. And long story short, I won first prize.
Right on.
Yeah. And the reason was because I found that the clicking, the tick-tock of a clock impacted the growth of plants tremendously because I was living in apartments. I couldn't play music 24 hours a day. Well, fast forward several decades, I'm reading and I had found out through my research that high-pitched sitar music and violin music actually makes plants grow the fastest. And so, but I thought, well, maybe because it makes the cytoplasm flow faster or something. I wasn't quite sure. Well, I come to find out several decades later, I'm reading, and they're saying that birdsong has the same megahertz as violin music. And all of a sudden, again, the light bulb goes off in my head, and I went, oh, my goodness, birdsong makes the plants grow. And then I did more research, and it was that the vibrations of birdsong, the high-pitched vibrations of birdsong, opens up the stomata on the bottom of the leaves. And that's how they grow faster. They absorb the air and the nutrients through their stomata.
Wow.
Isn't that fascinating?
I've never heard that. That's amazing.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
The birds make the plant, and the plant, when do plants grow? They grow the most in the early morning. When do the birds sing? Early morning.
Right.
And I just, 3 days ago, I'm walking down my little front walkway, and the bees are all out because I plant everything for bees nowadays. And all of a sudden, I hear the bees buzzing, and I go, oh, my God, I wonder if the bees buzzing is the same frequency as the bird song. I mean, I wonder if it's just one giant web.
Orchestra, right.
Yeah.
So following up on understanding that everything is so connected, and we are so connected to trees, I did a lot of research on this, too. When you stand with a tree and you just have this deep silence, you might feel a little silly, but when you strengthen your receptive abilities, when you kind of just stand there and just try to touch the trunk of a tree or something, after a few minutes, honest to goodness, you can feel a difference. So that if you go to the trunk of an oak tree and touch it and stand there for just a little bit, and then you go over, and I've done this, to the trunk of a beautiful tree called a katsura tree,
mm-hmm.
or a white pine tree, or a birch, you will literally feel a difference. It's kind of like shaking hands with people. When mm-hmm. you shake hands with a person, you can kind of feel a difference between one person and the other.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with trees. You can feel it. And again, all the various cultures of the world ascribe the same qualities to the tree species. Like, everyone
admits that the oak tree is a symbol of endurance and courage. You know,
yeah.
The mighty oak.
Right. Yes.
And all the cultures talk about birch trees as being pliable and easy to get along with.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And one that, you know, like oaks, for example, if it's a symbol of courage, that is the tree that steadies us and you know, gives us strength and anchors us.
Right.
And I believe it's no accident that Peter Walker, the great landscape architect, chose oak trees, you know, the water oak trees, to be planted at the World Trade Center.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So he's tuned in. Peter Walker is very tuned in.
Do you know the work of Bill Logan?
No. Who is he?
Bill Logan is an arborist here in the city. His company is Urban Arborists, and he has written several books, one of which is titled Oak, and it's all about the social and biological history.
Oh, you'd love his writing.
Of the oak tree. It's an amazing book.
He also wrote a book on soil called...
Dirt.
Dirt, the ecstatic something
the of ecstatic the... ecstatic skin of the earth.
Of the earth. I think you too would...
That sounds wonderful. I would definitely look up Bill Logan,
Bill Logan, yeah. He's written several books. He's been on our show.
I think you guys are kindred spirits.
Yeah, he does all of our tree work.
Yes.
Wow, okay. So thank you so much for that.
Well, Jan, when you talk with clients about, you know, the practical matters of choosing trees, are you able to get into this realm with them, you know, and that aspect of the process? And or
people are when you talk trees, people can relate.
Okay.
You know, when I get any farther afield than trees, not so much, but trees people love. People love, you know, you talk about planting, say, like a beech tree, and beech trees are the tree of learning and prosperity, and people love beech trees, you know, and it becomes a very personal thing. I have a personal love of witch hazels, and I remember trying to explain to a client how, you know, please plant witch hazels, they're very good energy. And I kind of lost him there, you know.
Once you say the word energy,
I didn't use that word anymore. But I just said, you know, they're very easy to grow, and they're native trees, and you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. So one thing that that I loved about all of your work is the color palette. It's very soft and subtle with these kind of punches of color, but it's not in your face. It's very local. And tell us a little bit about the mysteries of color.
Okay, well, you know, when I give my talks too, I always say that you should use the color that you like. Like some people just love, you know, red, and they like the power of red. And I say, well, I ask people, what colors do you like? And they'll say, I love red. I say, okay, let's incorporate red in your garden. And so I always kind of find out what colors people really enjoy, and one color universally that everybody loves is blue. Everybody loves blue gardens, yet you as designers know that blue gardens are probably the hardest garden to design because blue recedes. It's what they call a very shy color. It doesn't want to be called out. It wants to hide in the shadows,
right?
So I talk about that, the allure of a blue garden in the book, but then in how do you make blue stand out, right? How do you do it? And one way you do it is you always put blue in the front of the border. Don't put it in the back. Put it always in the front because, you know, it's like pushing the shy kid to the front of the class.
Right.
And so that's one of the things I do. And also I use, like, blue textures, like blue evergreens, like Weeping Atlas cedars, because it's an evergreen, but it's blue, and it's just something that calls to people. And so I try to incorporate blue flowers all the time because everybody loves blue, like, you know, catmint or angelonia or alliums or... Caryopteris or blue fescue. I mean, yeah, I try to use a lot of blue.
What I recall from your pictures was also the use of the kind of satellite neighboring colors. So there was a lot of silver and there was a lot of purple, which can bring about the idea of blue without being blue.
Yeah.
And that was what struck me, actually, was you would creating these kind of overall hues with the neighboring colors versus...
Yes. And you know, the other thing too is adding white, because white always seems to bring out the other colors better.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is true, Jan. Alice and I, a lot of clients want a lot of color, and the city space is limited.
And they're dark.
And they're dark spaces, and very often they want a lot of color. And sometimes we have to really push when I send them the sort of, you know, images of the flowers or plants and all the different colors and textures, we always include white. And there's sometimes resistance to it. They said, oh, well, white, that's a non-color. And I said, no, the white...
Oh, that's interesting.
I know. The white is important. The white is very important to balance and to
neutralize.
And it almost is like a palette blender, you know? And people and people don't understand that. They're like, well, I don't want white. Get me that plant in a different color. I said, no, you need white.
Yeah.
You need white. You know, you can't have all this and not have some white. And then when they do listen to us and they give in and they pay attention, they understand and they realize why we were right.
When we've willed them to our side.
And you want to know, we're coming in the time of year where we have the dark nights. You know, September, October is the time of the very dark nights, right?
Right.
And when you have, but you still have the flowers growing. You still have, like, the white lantana growing and white chrysanthemums and white New Guinea impatiens.
Yeah.
And if you plant those in your garden, and the Montauk daisies, now is when they're going to be glowing in the evening.
It's true.
It's magical.
Haven't you noticed that the moonflowers are outrageous this year?
Oh, I haven't, but I wonder if this has anything to do with the moon.
I don't know, but the moon parents at my parents' house, the moonflowers at my parents' house are... I mean, they are saucers, and they just will not stop. They are just going and going and going.
Oh, that's great.
And it's just amazing. And we have a gray house and then these white flowers against it. And it's it's just illuminating. It's unbelievable.
Literally illuminating.
Yeah.
You know what I have in my little tiny backyard? I have the variegated dogwood, the shrub form, right?
Uh-huh.
The variegated dogwood.
Uh-huh.
And... it is just now, at this time in the fall, it still has its leaves, and it just glows in the nighttime.
Yeah. We use that shrub a lot in backyards in Manhattan and in Brooklyn that are dark. It really is amazing because it just lightens up the space. That and Hackinacloa and Achorus and all those yellow and white variegated plants are amazing for that.
I think that's something that your listeners would probably like to know about, too, is what plants are super tough and yet, you know, look great all year round and does, like, blends the green and the white together. Like, I love the Carex ice dance.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And where I live, deer is such a problem, and the deer don't touch it. So it's one of our, you know, popular plants.
Good. Well, so you also have this blog called Serenity in the Garden, which is
thank you.
Just amazing. And I was very taken with a quote that you pulled from Jeffrey Jellicoe. The world is moving into a phase when landscape design may be well recognized as the most comprehensive of the arts. And I found that so perfect, considering all the things that your designs kind of come from, all of your training and all of your spirituality. Do you tell us a little bit about how you chose that quote?
You know, Jeffrey Jellicoe, J-E-L-L-I-C-O-E, Jellicoe, he's not really pushed a lot. You know, people don't really know who he is. I mean, if you're English, you certainly do.
Right.
But in this country, not. And I think he is one of the greatest writers on landscaping and the history of gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading his book, and that was just one of the lines in the paragraph as I was reading it. And I thought, oh, my goodness, that is so profound.
Yeah.
And he wrote it, several decades ago.
Right.
And it's so true, isn't it? I mean, not only do you have to know all the plant varieties and everything, you have to know everything there is to know about soil and light and drainage and paving. And it's just, it's comprehensive, just
right.
like he said. And
yeah.
I read that and I said, bravo, bravo.
Yeah, it's design, it's art history, it's color theory. It's,
that's right.
It's, you know, English literature. It's everything wrapped up into one, you know. It's culture.
And it's been relegated, you know, for so long, landscape design or garden design. And finally, I believe that people are starting to say, well, the design of our outdoor spaces is just as important, if not more important, than the design of our indoor spaces.
I think so.
I agree, especially as outdoor space becomes more and more a commodity. I mean,
right.
and more of a rarity.
Right.
You know, I think it's harder for people now to be able to afford a home with a little bit of outdoor space, so
that's
that
right.
when you do have it, you want to make the most of it, you
yeah.
know? And Allison and I are finding that the sort of next generation of home buyers, you know, that are a little bit younger than us, they're not necessarily wanting gardens per se like their parents did, Jan. I don't know
right.
if you're experiencing that, but they want more of an environment, like what you know,
yes.
you're creating.
The outdoor room.
The outdoor,
yeah.
like,
yes.
living space, so that they want to enjoy it and appreciate it, but they're not wanting to be mini horticulturists or mini botanists. They're not
no.
into that. They want to feel a certain way. You can definitely,
yeah.
you know, add to that because...
Because I don't have a space and I'm depressed all the time.
Well, no, I meant in the
yeah.
sense of people, people asking us,
yeah.
you know, they're not necessarily saying, I definitely want a rose and I definitely want a hydrangea. I want to feel this
mm-hmm.
way or that way. Jen,
exactly,
you know?
And that is exactly what I'm addressing.
Yeah.
How do you make outdoor spaces that make you feel good? And people would say to me, they'd go into these projects that I would do, whether it's big or small, and they say, I don't know what it is, but when I just walk in there, I just feel so good.
Yeah.
And I say, thank you so much. And it wasn't about, like, who did this, who designed it. It was more
no.
like,
no.
wow, this just feels so good. I want to stay here for a while. I want to linger here for a while.
I spent hours looking at your website, at the photos.
Oh,
I felt
thank
like
you so much.
It was lovely, just
yes.
gorgeous
and
work.
And it is a labor of love, I have to say. I started my blog, Serenity in the Garden, several years ago, and I would wake up and I would just run to the computer to write before I went off to earn my
yeah.
living, you know, which
yeah.
is similar to the way you guys work.
Well, you have a lot of upcoming lectures, right? Can you?
Yes, I am. I'm speaking in Lenox, Massachusetts next week to the Lenox Garden Club, and I'm also going to be teaching a class at the New York Botanic Gardens on stonework in the garden in early November.
Ooh, I want to take that
class. I want to take that, too.
Yeah, it's a one-day class. It's really very popular. I mean, they keep asking me to give the same class every year.
Yeah.
I talk about the spirit of stone. I talk about how to read stones, how to place stones in the garden, how the Japanese used to do it. It's very popular.
Yeah.
Well, Jan, we could talk to you for hours, but unfortunately, our time has run short.
Yeah.
Great.
We
Great.
Are going to post all about your blog and the book and links to your website after the show. And we'd love to have you back sometime
I would love
in the
it.
Future.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for being on We Dig
Thank
Plants.
You for your work. Beautiful.
Yes.
Thanks again. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. So you've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Today's engineer was Liz Smith. Today's break music was provided by Knife Show. The theme song to our show is provided by Paul Andrew Watling, otherwise known as
Supercompute Global.
Today's sponsor is Edwards Virginia Ham. I have tasted their ham. It's amazing.
Carmen said it was better than prosciutto.
I know. And then a lightning bolt came and struck me. So thank you, listener, for tuning in. If you like what you heard, tell your friends to subscribe to the show on iTunes. And feel free to get in touch with us at heritageradionetwork.org. I also wanted to add on a personal note. One of my goals for October is to listen to at least once each of the 30 plus shows. So I'm going to do 30 shows or more in 30 days. And I hope that you join me in at least trying some other shows on the network, because there's so many that are great. Next up is a short clip of Evolutionaries, another great show found right here on the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Happy gardening.
I think think talking about the ingredients is I don't know if disingenuous is the right thing, but I find it a little tiresome to say, well, we go and get the best ingredients. No shit, we get the best ingredients too.
Chef Wiley Dufresne shares his thoughts on ingredients and cooking.
Now, if you want to talk about the farmers, you want to talk about the people who are putting their hands in the ground, because that's a really hard job. That job's not fun at all. And I think that we can talk about them forever, and I think we should talk about them. The people that help harvest our ingredients are important. But to talk about, well, we got this really good, okay, me too. You know, it's your job as a chef to start with the best ingredients. What you choose to do with them is, I think, totally up to you. And one is not right and one is not wrong. I do think it's wrong to start with, well, we get, let's talk about these ingredients. Like, we don't talk about the beautiful fish that we have flown in from Japan twice a week for you, because we believe that you should expect us to source good ingredients. And that's my feeling, is that any chef worth his or her weight wants to start with good product for any number of reasons. You want to have good product. You want to have good equipment to work with that product. Is somebody out there going, I have the crappiest ingredients and rusty pans and we make awesome food. Come on down. I mean, nobody's saying that. That's crazy. No, we start with good ingredients, and we have an approach on how we want to handle them and what we want to do with them, as does every other chef. And I think let's talk, you know, talk about what you're doing. Not talk about where you shopped, because that's not as compelling a story.
For more of Wiley's stories and thoughts, listen to Evolutionaries, available on iTunes and HeritageRadioNetwork.org.